Author Ken Belson explores what the NFL is today and how it got here in his new book, Every Day is Sunday. We're lucky to be joined by him this morning. Good morning, Ken, and welcome to Mountain Money.
Thanks for having me on.
Sorry about our little technical glitch. We don't have instant replay here on Mountain Money, so we're just going to have to go forward. So, Ken, tell us what motivated you to write this book, and how long did it take you to do the research?
Well, what motivated me was I was covering the NFL or the business of the NFL for about a dozen years. And there's so much stuff that never gets in the newspaper. Observations, asides, obviously quotes, details. And I felt like there was a broader story to tell than just the collection of my newspaper stories. So I guess technically in terms of research, it took me 10, 12 years. But the actual writing the book was about 2 years.
And again, just so people understand your background, you were doing, tell us a little bit about the nature of the reporting you were doing on the NFL during those years.
Yeah, sure. So in 2009, I've been a business writer for 30 years. I've been overseas. I've been here in the States doing a variety of business writing. And in 2009, I was moved over to the sports section to write about the business of sports. It's a vast area, even just in New York, all the networks, the big sponsors, the big, all the leagues are located here. And I thought it was a great opportunity. I covered all the sports and a variety of issues, stadiums, team transactions, you name it, for 4 years. And in 2013, I had been writing about the lawsuits involving the former players, the NFL players, suing the NFL for damages related to concussions. And my editor said, you know, why don't you just cover the business of the NFL? It's the biggest, it sets the trends. You know, everybody focuses on it. And so I was really given kind of a blank slate to cover the league. And, you know, I'd cover a handful of games a year, but really that wasn't my mandate. My mandate was to try and figure out how these incredibly wealthy teams and owners got to be even more wealthy.
And that, of course, is a natural segue. You trace the rise of the modern NFL from the early 1990s. What began to change at that point?
Sure. So in the, you know, it's hard to believe now, given how big the NFL is, but in the 1980s were a really sort of damaging time for the NFL. You had a lawsuit by the upstart USFL, started by Donald Trump, led to a whole host of antitrust fallout. There were teams moving, Baltimore in the dead of night, the Colts left and went to Indianapolis, and you had the owners resisting the players pushing for free agency. That was the last major league to grant free agency. And there were games missed in 1982, and then in 1987, there were scab players used. It was a really kind of ugly time for the league, at least on the business side and in some ways on the player side. So 1993, they have a new commissioner, Paul Tagliabue. He's was the outside lawyer for the league. And he really brought the owners and the union together and said, you know, we're killing each other. We're only going to get past this if we figure out a formula that works for everybody. And that included free agency for the players in 1993 and a salary cap for the owners so you wouldn't have runaway spending. And most importantly, you had revenue sharing. From that point on, most of the revenue of the league, particularly the TV contracts, were shared 50-50. And Gene Upshaw, the old union president and former Hall of Famer, he said, you know, we are now partners, which is not your typical union stance. And that put the foundation under the league starting in 1993, and it's really been upward since then.
Good. So now you identify Jerry Jones, Robert Kraft, Roger Goodell as keys to the rise of the league. Let's start with Roger Goodell. Can you share a bit about his career arc and the characteristics that have allowed him to be successful for so long?
Yeah. Yeah, Roger's got a resume of one. He literally graduated from college and said, I want to be NFL commissioner, and actually did it. I'm not sure how many kids in the early 1980s, that's what they aspired to do, but he actually went about doing it. That's the first thing. The second thing is when you work at the NFL for 45 years, and remember back when he joined in 1981, 82, there were only about 100 people in the league back then. So you knew everybody, and you knew the owners, and you knew their families, and you knew what they needed. And so Roger made a name for himself solving problems. And one of those problems, just as an example, is stadiums. The owners don't want to get their hands dirty going to City Hall trying to negotiate deals. That's what Roger did. His father was a senator. and a congressman. He had that diplomatic skill. And so by the time 2006 comes around and they're looking for a new commissioner, all the owners knew Roger. They knew of him. He had done favors for them, and he was really the natural choice. One thing that I think is often misunderstood about Roger is that he's not really a CEO in the traditional corporate sense. Of course, he is the guy who lays out the vision for the league, but he's very much doing the bidding of the owners. The NFL, more than the other major leagues, is owner-driven, and so he's really more like a Senate majority leader. He's always counting votes. He's always trying to figure out how to get to a majority, particularly a supermajority, which in the NFL's case is 24 out of 32 owners. So he's always reading the room. You know, he rarely puts his neck out on particular issues. It's really what he's doing is channeling what the owners want.
And talk a little bit more about his management style. I mean, this has got to be a really, really difficult job, given the egos and the money of all these people he has to cater to.
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, Roger is more of a listener than a talker. He hires good people, talented marketing people and lawyers and whatnot. And, you know, he doesn't have an MBA. He doesn't have a finance degree. He doesn't have a marketing degree. He has learned on the job over these many years. But, you know, the world moves on, right? So technology has changed, for instance, and he hired or has hired numerous people who were experts in cable television and other things, streaming. The new general counsel of the league came from Facebook, a sign of the times, right? Rather than getting a lawyer from a white shoe firm, he gets somebody who's basically litigating the future. So that's where Roger's strengths are. He kind of knows what he doesn't know. But, you know, look, his experience has been almost entirely at the NFL, and that in some ways is a blind spot, right? He hasn't seen how the rest of the world lives. But maybe the owners don't care, right? I mean, maybe the owners hire him to make him more money, and he's very good at that.
And he had a target of revenue that he wanted to reach by, what was it, 2027? We'll get to that. First of all, what was that target, and is he going to get there?
Yes, it was 2010. He said, I'd like the league to be at $25 billion in revenue by 2027. So that was basically 2.5 times what they were at in 17 years. And they are very much on pace to do that. At the time he said it, the owners were shaking their heads like, really? Go for it, guy. But he's gotten there, particularly the media deals, the labor deals they did in 2011 and 2020. They've added a regular season game. They've added more playoff inventory. And something that probably wasn't anticipated back in 2010, we have companies, or the league has companies like Amazon and Google / YouTube and Netflix, lining up to pay even more money to broadcast NFL games.
Jeez, a lot of money there. So let's continue on. Jerry Jones, he's the owner that fans love to hate. How is his relationship with the team different from that of other owners?
Sure. Well, Jerry is unique in numerous ways. He's kind of a unicorn as well. You know, he's the only owner who is also the GM, which is why a lot of fans don't like him. You know, he was a collegiate player. He won a national championship in 1964. So legitimately, he has football on his resume. But let's face it, they weren't doing speed. They didn't have chips in the shoulder pads of players back in 1964. The world moves fast. It's so much more analytically driven now. It's a full-time job. So for him to have both titles is kind of unheard of, and maybe even reckless, depending if you're a Cowboys fan. But I have to say, Jerry, as a businessman, has done more than any other owner over the period of time he's been in the league, and maybe ever, to grow the league. As Carmen Policy, the old president of the Niners, used to say, Jerry taught us how to make money. You know, a lot of the owners back in the 80s, the ones that were making money were comfortable doing what they were doing. There was no free agency, so salaries were kept low. There wasn't the motivation. Jerry comes in, he pays a record amount for the Cowboys, goes heavily into debt, and he's hungry. And Jerry has ideas. The title of the chapter on Jerry is, I like to smear that Cowboys peanut butter on everything. And that's true. He's done marketing deals. He has an entire... The Star, which is a practice facility, essentially all branded Cowboys. And he pushes the envelope more than any other owner.
Did he also push the idea of the Dallas Cowboys cheerleaders? Was he behind
that? No, that predated him. That was in the 70s, and they were already the biggest thing going. And I think Jerry understood viscerally that the Cowboys were, at least in their own imagination, America's team, and they were really undervalued. If you go back and look at stadiums back in the 70s, there wasn't a lot of signage. The luxury suites were relatively modest. They weren't pushed the way they are now. Jerry really had an idea to turn it even more into a luxury event. And, you know, other teams have since followed.
And he led the way in a number of things. I think you talk about sort of brand identification where he cuts a deal. I want to say with Pepsi, he does a lot of merchandise branding. And I take it at first the other owners didn't like it, but then they realized this might be a pretty good idea for us to make money.
Yeah, he got them kicking and screaming, dragged them into the next century. You alluded to Pepsi. You know, the NFL's official soda at the time was Coke, and Jerry said, well, but I have my stadium, so why can't I sell them a Pepsi sponsorship? The league had Reebok, he went out and got Nike. The league had Visa, he went out and got Amex. And he was cheeky in a way that this is, I think, more than anything what pissed the owners off. He literally brought Phil Knight, the founder of Nike, down onto the field before a Cowboys-Giants game. He was rubbing the league's nose in it. There were dueling lawsuits, but at the end of the day, he won the day. He won the right to market within his territory, as did every other team. So now you have national sponsorships and you have local sponsorships, and it's up to every team to sell as much as they want to sell.
That's just like TV commercials when you watch a game. You know, you've got the local advertising and the national advertising.
That's right. That's right.
So Kraft is a far less visible and flamboyant figure, although he has popped up a few times.
Whoops.
He's also been a major influence on the growth of the league. Let's talk about what he brings to the table.
Sure. You know, if Jerry is the idea man, Robert is the closer. He's got good skills or instincts for how to present a win-win for all sides in various business deals. You know, there is an instinct among some owners to take as much as you can get. Dan Snyder, the old owner of the Commanders, was point, you know, number one on that. But, you know, Robert's idea is you can't bleed all your partners dry. CBS and Fox and NBC, like, it's good to leave some money on the table because you got to work with these people in the next bunch of years, and there's no point in bankrupting them. So he's really the guy, I wouldn't say moderation, but he try and designs deals that, you know, give something back to the other side. He knows the NFL is in a great position in terms of broadcast rights. But, you know, taking everything at once isn't the best strategy. Now, he's not necessarily the ideas guy, although sometimes he is. Jerry might be credited as the guy who comes up with some of these ideas, but Jerry doesn't necessarily get it across the finish line. Robert had a great quote about Jerry. He said he could charm a dog off a meat truck. when he gets an idea, he sticks with it. But, you know, at a certain point, you have to take a step back and let the other side, you know, win something too.
You know, a few months ago, we got to interview D. Smith about his book. And one of the things he talked about was the dramatic role that Kraft played in a union management confrontation. And that it was really Kraft that made that deal happen against some fairly significant odds.
Yeah, D was obviously right there, and he knew and saw it firsthand. Right, so you had in this is the 2011 labor deal. There was a lockout of 136 days. And, you know, you had an array of owners on their side of the table, and Jerry Jones and Jerry Richardson, the late owner of the Panthers, were very much on the let's push the envelope side of the table. Jerry wanted 18 games back then. Remember, it was only 16, so he wanted two additional games at a time when the players were worried about concussions. So he wasn't really listening. In money terms, he saw what he wanted. And it was Robert who intervened and really won the trust of the players. And I'm sure Dee pointed out, Robert's wife was deathly ill at the time.
Yeah.
And he earned the respect of the players by coming back to the table when he probably should have been at his wife's bedside.
Another sort of event that struck me as having really widespread implications was the period in which Fox obtains an NFL contract, which I think leads both to a change in broadcast for the NFL and, frankly, the growth of the Fox network.
Yeah, absolutely. And frankly, an explosion of rights deals across sports. This was one of Jerry's, I think, great contributions was he joined the media committee, which was then much smaller. It was basically Pat Bowlen, the owner of the Broncos back then. And Jerry shows up and he says, wait a second, you got three deals. You got NFC, AFC, Monday Night Football, and you only have three bidders, CBS, NBC, and ABC. Who runs a business like that? That's clubby, right? Let's get another bidder in here and run an auction. And that auction started with Rupert Murdoch, who had tried twice to get in and was not taken seriously. And Jerry told Rupert Murdoch, you're not going to be a stalking horse. We'll take you seriously. It was really a remarkable risk for the NFL. There was no sports. Rupert didn't have any news division, he didn't have any sports division. There was no Fox Sports, no TV people, no announcers, no logos. And they basically trusted him based on the idea that he had the English Premier League at that time. And so when he knocks CBS out, he basically hires all of CBS, including John Madden and Pat Summerall, and brings them over, and in 7 months is on the air. John Madden joked that they shouldn't call it Fox Sports. They should call it Fox Sport because they only had one league at the time. But it was really an amazing risk by the NFL, but also by Fox, and it worked dramatically because the other leagues saw what Jerry and the NFL did. And so the NBA and baseball and others started getting multiple bidders in for their contract offers or broadcast deals. And that led to an explosion in money spent by the networks.
Now, obviously, televised NFL is very popular. How do the rule changes affecting instant replay, pass interference, allow the NFL to create a better television product experience?
Yeah, one of the chapters, really the only chapter in the book that really discusses the game was one that where I discuss how do they change the rules over time. And there's the basic formula is points, penalties, and plays. Plays and penalties equal points. And so basically the NFL has found historically that roughly 44 points a game total is about the right mix of action, both for people in the stadium, watching at home, and I suppose so for people betting. There's enough stuff on the field. And it was interesting to watch over time, certainly after World War II, how this very slow-moving, run-oriented game opened up in the 50s with the Cleveland Browns and into the 60s when they merged with the AFL, which was a much more wide open sport. It slowed down in the 70s. If you think back to the 70s, it was the Purple People Eaters and the Steel Curtain, all these defenses. Those were the real stars of the game. And then comes Bill Walsh and the West Coast offense, and the 80s were all about scoring. And over time, it's been roughly steady at about 44 points a game. It goes up and down, give or take. But that seems to be the right mix. And so year in and year out, they tweak the rules a little bit, some of them for safety reasons, like the kickoff rule.
Yep.
But sometimes just to allow the game to open up and scoring to increase. Defensive interference and that rule has been tinkered with numerous times. Hitting the quarterback, that kind of thing, hitting helmet hits and so forth. There's been a mixture of safety innovations, but also scoring as well.
And instant replay, when it was first coming in, it was pretty controversial among the owners. How did they come to embrace it?
Yeah, so, of course, controversy. A lot of these rule changes that we're discussing are often brought to the table by aggrieved owners in the previous year. So this doesn't happen just simply neutrally, but they're very thorough in the sense that they review it. Replay came in the 80s, and it was too slow. I mean, the amount of time that referees were under the hood looking at video, they had to leave the field to do it. We're dealing not in the digital age, right? So they're literally rolling tape back. And so it was very clunky. And over a few years, the fans were complaining and owners were complaining. They scrapped it until a key Jets game in the late 1990s on a very obvious non-touchdown called a touchdown. And it was such a obvious mistake that the NFL actually had to admit it the next day that the referee should not have called a touchdown for Vinny Testaverde, the quarterback, and it had playoff implications and so forth. There was even a push to rush in instant replay just for that year's playoffs because it was such a problem. So really, since the late 90s, they brought it back, and it's been pretty steady since then. As you know, they keep refining it. Now there's tablets. There's guys in New York watching. It's much more digitized.
There was a period of time when, I know that I thought that the NFL might well go the way of boxing, and that it would be the sport that was once huge, but because, people were getting knocked out and having CTE, that it was never going to survive, and that people were not going to let their kids play. I was wrong. What happened?
Yeah, I've written a lot about players, player health, the game itself. And it's disturbing to me as a reporter. Often these players who are no longer in the spotlight, some of them really in financial straits, being taken care of by their wives. For a period of time that you're alluding to, and sort of around 2010, 2015, moms were saying, I don't want my kid wearing pads and a helmet. I'm going to put him in soccer or some other sport. Mm-hmm. And some of that still exists. But in the chapter on CTE and concussions and that crisis, I found documents in depositions, court records, where the NFL is very deliberately, starting in 2010, trying to change the narrative. And by and large, it has worked, at least in the public perception. They brought in, focused on helmets, taking players off the field if they appear concussed, a return to play guidelines, the rules of the game, like the kickoff and so forth. And they spent a ton of money and are still spending a ton of money trying to win over moms with things like flag football. And so I would not say the game is tremendously safer. It's still a highly dangerous game, particularly at the NFL level where the speeds are so fast. But they have at least changed the narrative that it appears that the NFL is coming up with quote-unquote solutions. And you see this. I mean, the reporting on player health has really diminished and disappeared in some ways. So that doesn't mean that players aren't getting sick. It just means that we're not focused on it as much. And, the NFL has made improvements to the pro game, but at the end of the day, they don't control the rest of the football universe, college, high school, and all the way down.
Now, do we notice the NFL players have a longer number of years?
No. If you're asking me for health reasons, that's incidental. It's all about money. If anything, the gap between the highest paid players and the lowest paid players has grown. So the amount of money that a Patrick Mahomes or Dak Prescott gets means there's just, because the NFL has a salary cap, there's only so much money to go around, that the percentage of players making the minimum is growing. So it's the only way you can afford these big stars. And you saw this with Jerry Jones. He let Micah Parsons go. Mm-hmm. He claimed he couldn't afford to cut a deal with him because he had money to spend on other players too. It's a legitimate argument. Whether it's true or not, I don't know. But that was the one he made, was I can't pay everybody the max. Now, in baseball, you can, because there's no cap on payroll. But in football, there's only so much you can spend. So the quarterbacks are making a lot more. The star players, the wide receivers and so forth, are getting a lot more than they used to. Offensive tackles are still paid a huge amount. And then there's everybody else. And that really was the success of the Patriots in the 2000s, was they built a roster around Tom Brady and a bunch of guys who are helping Tom Brady. If you think of other stars, Julian Edelman and so forth, there's some wide receivers, but most of them were not paid the mega money. And that's how he kept that dynasty going.
Yeah, and it definitely kept going. So now, switching gears, at the end of the day, do you see gambling as a threat or an asset to the NFL?
I see it as a threat. That's my personal view. I think that it is increasing the fragmentation of sports and the way that fans interact with sports. And by the way, this isn't just the NFL, but it's primarily the NFL because it's the most gambled on sport and gambled on league. I think fans are less and less willing to literally go to a game. It's the TV product is immensely compelling. If you add Sunday Ticket and Red Zone, and then you throw in the gambling you can do on your iPad while you're, you know, take prop bets. You know, you could do that at the stadium, but you'll be, you know, cold and probably uncomfortable. So I just think fans are going to disengage a little bit from it. I mean, it's already going on. The book Dopamine Nation kind of scratched this already. And, you know, if you think about the evolution from, you know, EA and Madden video games through fantasy football, gambling is the next logical iteration of it. And it, except that now there's money on the line, and that just changes the dynamic, the anger level. You now hear more and more players talking about how they feel threatened or are threatened. And I just think that diminishes the game itself. I don't think people watch games the way they used to, where they appreciate, you know, the arc of a 3-hour game.
The book is Every Day is Sunday. We've had the privilege of talking to author Ken Belson. Ken, thanks for spending time with us this morning.
Sure, appreciate it, guys.
We'll be right back after this.